I want us today to talk about the empty tomb. The more I study the New Testament, the more I see that the emphasis in the New Testament is over the fact that Jesus died, He was raised, and He's now Lord of lords and King of kings. We tend to preach about redemptions, and we should, and sanctification, and we should, because that's the emphasis a lot of times in the epistles of Paul. But if you begin thinking about the proclamation of the gospel, it all has to do with the empty tomb. Now, I'm not going to ask you to do this, but if I were to ask everyone who is here who believes in the resurrection to raise your hand, I think it'd be 100% of individuals doing that. I may ask you to do that mentally a little bit later in this lesson once we talk about what does it really, really mean to believe in the resurrection. Jesus came into the coast of Caesarea Philippi, and He asked His disciples, that's what our text said, who do men say that I am? You see, that's the decision they had to face. It's a decision people in the first century had to face, and you and I are going to have to face that same decision. Who is this man Jesus? Jesus of Nazareth. We know a lot about Him. We know far more about Him than those in the first century knew about Him, because we know the totality of His life, and yet when He was there, He had not lived all of His life. Let me talk to you about the implications of this text and the very question and the very comments that we have made. We need to understand that Jesus is a man of history. There are fables about the lives of individuals, many of them written hundreds of years after that particular individual lived. Think about the nobility of Hannibal, about Alexander the Great, and all the things that have come about from being men of history. And then there is mythology about the gods. You study the Greek gods, and many of them have individuals who came and fought great battles and did great things. But I want you to understand that Jesus is a man of history. What you know about Jesus was not something that was created in the second or third or fourth century in order that there might be a new religion on this earth based on human wisdom. Jesus lived. Jesus died. Jesus was buried. He was raised, and He ascended into heaven. You and I need to understand that if you did not have a Bible, if all you had was other ancient writings, not by any way as well documented as the writings of the New Testament, but Josephus was a historian who lived in that very first century. And we have the writings of Josephus, and Josephus talks about Jesus and says He was the Christ. Now, there's a difference in saying He was the Messiah and that impacting your life. But here's a man who never was a Christian. And when he writes about this man of history in the first century, and we have his writings, and in the first century he says, He was the Christ. You look at the writings of Suetonius. He wrote a book called The 12 Caesars that described in the latter part of the first century. He describes those Caesars and talks about each of the 12 Caesars that had ruled in his lifetime, beginning with Julius Caesar. Guess what? He talks about Jesus, and he talks about Him using the word Christos, the word Christ. Not that he was a believer in Christ, but he lived at a time when there were those individuals who looked at that man Jesus, and a common way of referring to Jesus was to call Him the Messiah. Who do men say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Thou art the Christos. And if you did not even have a Bible, you would know that a man named Jesus lived. He was the Christ. In fact, Josephus also talks about Jesus' brother named James. You know that individual, do you not? James, the brother of Jesus. That's not biblical. That is secular writings talking about the very fact that Jesus is a man of history. Now you add to this the writings of the New Testament. It's not our purpose in this lesson to describe the authenticity of the Bible, nor to show all the evidence there is that the Bible is an ancient book. It is what it claimed to be. But there were eyewitnesses. And the apostles on the day of Pentecost says, and we were eyewitnesses. We saw him. In fact, when Peter gets near the end of his life, he looks back and he says in 2 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 16, look, this is not some fable that somebody's thought up. It is not some cunningly devised fable that some individuals interested in starting a new religion that they might be a part of. That's not what it is. It is not something like a televangelist might do in some of the things that they advocate that they have done in their life. It is not a cunningly devised story. We were eyewitnesses, and then Peter said, and we were with him in the Holy Mount at the Transfiguration. We were not only eyewitnesses, we were ear witnesses, for we heard the voice of God saying, this is my Son. Jesus lived. And he thereby has become the central character of history. In a recent sermon within the last month, we asked, what year is this? What's happened in 2020? What happened in the year zero? There was a man who lived on this earth whose impact was such that before he lived on this earth, time is marked by the date of his birth. And since that birth, time is marked by us living in the year of our Lord. Jesus is a man of history. Now the point we're trying to make is, those who lived in the first century had to decide, who is he? You could not live there in the first century with the impact that he was having. You could not live there in the first century without having to make some decision about him. Think about being in the multitudes and you were following him. Think about hearing what happened at the multitudes. Think about hearing of all they had done when everybody that was brought to him was cured and healed of whatever sickness there was, 100% of them. You were forced in the first century. Who is he? He's Beelzebub. And those who were more honest in their appraisal said, he's like Moses. He's like Elijah. He's like one of the prophets. He's like John the Baptist raised from the dead. They had to make it. They were forced to decide on the basis of his life to examine the claims that he made and to decide who he was. And they were forced to deal with the empty tomb. That's what this lesson is all about. This truth that they were forced to face is the truth that you are forced to face this very day. And the very design of this sermon is to call upon you to be honest enough to look at the evidence that is here and then to make a decision. And it is as though Jesus is saying to you, who do men say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Teenagers, you do not need to believe Jesus is the Messiah because your parents believe Jesus is the Messiah. It's your own decision. And those who lived in that first century were forced to deal with that. And so today's lesson is to discuss and ask very briefly, what about it, that empty tomb? What happened to the body? It is to look at the claims that he made before he died, and then to look at the response that was made. You see, the question is, as you face the empty tomb, what happened to the body? There are two facts that no one denies: that he died, and that there was an empty tomb on that Sunday morning. Those are facts. You look at those facts, then you need to understand that you've got to face the question, where is his body? Now, there's a rumor in the first century. Matthew chapter 28 told about the officials who did everything they could to keep there being any talk of his resurrection. He had talked about it. He had prophesied it. And so after he died, Matthew 28, they went to the officials and said, let's put guards outside that tomb. Why? Because he said he was going to be raised, and we do not want anybody breaking in that tomb. And so they were given permission to put guards outside the tomb. When the resurrection came about, do you know what the rumor was? The rumor was his disciples came. That's what Matthew 28 says. But the truth behind all of that is, in Matthew 28, they were given money. They were not just given money. They were given large sums of money. You know what's wrong with their testimony? What were you doing when the disciples came? We were asleep. You see anything wrong with that testimony? How'd you like to be a lawyer in the court? How would you like to have that individual sitting in the witness chair, and you were what? And you were doing what at the time? Yes. And what happened? Well, there were some men that came. Who were those men? We saw them, and we know that it was, you saw them? That's not the answer. You see, the Jewish leaders tried to cover up his resurrection. What happened to his body? Some say the Jews came and stole his body before the disciples could. They could easily have gotten away around those guards that were there. They would have had that authority, and they could have said, let us take the body. What's wrong with that claim? Are you aware that the whole preaching of the New Testament in synagogues all over the New Testament world was Jesus died and he was buried, and the Jews rose up in anger in every place. All they had to do was, we stole the body and he's buried under that oak tree. The very fact that they could not produce a body, even if they had stolen the body. And by the way, there is zero evidence other than the imagination of some atheist who, when he's forced to face this empty tomb, says, well, I know what happened to his body. The Jews came and took his body so the disciples could not steal it. And other atheists have tried to deal with the empty tomb by saying grave robbers came. And there are the treasures, the ancient treasures in the pyramids. Think about King Tut and all of his riches. It's a rather interesting thing that in New Zealand, when the Polynesians were there, they buried the most prized possession that an individual had with the body. You go to a funeral of a Maori in New Zealand. The first time I ever saw it, I looked down in the grave. There is the casket made of polished wood that was there. And laying right on top of that casket was a real nice watch. I thought, somebody's dropped a watch in this. I didn't know you bury the most prized possession. When a child was buried, they buried his bicycle. They'd lower the body in the grave and then put the bicycle in there. One funeral that I went to with what I described as probably the laziest man I've ever known on this earth, when I was at his funeral, when they came to put in his prized possession, they buried a mattress with him. But there's a New Zealand word, tapu, to describe the sacredness of that ground. Tapu is the parallel to the English word taboo. You cannot go to a grave and rob a grave because it is tapu. It's taboo to desecrate that grave. But there are those who do that. Why? Well, there are riches that are there. But isn't it amazing? Isn't it amazing that those who came to get the treasures, the grave robbers, they took the body? Is that stupid? Can you imagine you're ready to rob a grave and what do? You've got to have a really sick mind to take a body out with you, a dead, stinking body. Behold, he stinketh. He's been dead. This is the third day. Behold, he stinketh. That's what they said of Lazarus. Where's that body? That's not what happened in the body. Some say the women on Sunday morning came to the wrong tomb. You know what's wrong with that claim? Not made by people of the first century. Made by atheists who want to destroy the very faith that you have in the resurrected, in the very resurrection of Jesus. What is wrong is that when the disciples came to the tomb, remember Peter and John running to the tomb, they came to the wrong tomb. Isn't it amazing that when on the day of Pentecost, less than two months later, Peter says, the tomb of David is outside this city. He wasn't talking about himself when he said, you'll not let my flesh see corruption. He was talking about the flesh of Jesus. And we have seen the resurrected Jesus. His flesh did not see corruption. And all they would have had to have said on that day to forever kill Christianity is, no, his tomb is right there. It belonged first to Joseph of Arimathea. And it's less than 2 miles from where David's tomb is. What happened to the body? Even more remarkable is that Jesus really was not dead. When he got in that cool tomb, he revived and he was able to do what that large group of women going toward the tomb were concerned about, their fact that we will not be able to roll away the stone. Can you imagine a man who has been beaten, who has been scourged? Can you imagine him with the bloody body that he has getting up inside that situation and being physically strong enough to move that tomb? Was he dead? The Romans who crucified Jesus were sent to say, is he really dead? And they looked at his body and they certified he was dead because they would not break the bones of his legs like they did of the others who were not dead. And isn't it amazing that if he was not dead, that as they were embalming his body and wrapping it in all of that clothing, isn't it amazing that not one time did anybody check his temperature to see if he was alive? You know what? He's dead. Some say Some say, I want you to understand, there are no some says that answer the question, what happened to the body? He was buried, and the tomb was emptied. There is no question that answers, where's his body? Other than the fact, God must have been behind this. Do you believe in the resurrection? Now, as we continue, let's take a moment and look at the claims that he made as to who he was. He spoke with authority. He did not say, as was common of the Jewish rabbis, behold, the rabbis think. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, after he had said, you have heard that it hath been said, and quoted the inspired scriptures of the Old Testament. You think those things were inspired of God? You think they did not have authority over mankind? Every time, over and over in that sermon, he said, you've heard that it hath been said, but I say unto you. Luke 4:32 said he taught them as one who had authority, because he did. Matthew chapter 7 said he spake not as scribes and Pharisees, for he taught them as one who had authority. I want you to understand, his teaching was different. It was authoritative. Look at the response to his miracles. Matthew chapter 9 and verse 30, beginning in verse 33, they're talking about the fact he's cast out demons by the power of Satan. And whenever he cured this individuals, they said, Matthew chapter 9, verse 32, we've never seen anything like this. They saw the miracles. You've not seen them, but with the eye of faith, you can stand and see that deaf mute who was cured by Jesus. In Mark chapter 2, they said in verse 12, when the man who had been let down from the open ceiling, Jesus said to him, take up your bed and walk. They said, we never saw anything like this. And in John chapter 4, the woman at the well says, we know that someday the Messiah is coming, and when he comes, he will tell us all things. And when in verse 29, she gets back into the city, she says, is this the Messiah? We'll come back to verse 25 in a moment that has the asterisk about it, but you need to understand how important that verse is. Jesus claimed that he was one with the Father. He and the Father are the same. Well, somebody said, he's the Son of God. Josiah, you are the son of Josh. Can he outrun you? Is he smarter than you? You better be careful. He's looking. Is he more handsome than you? Does his hair grow as well as you do? You see, the fact you're a son has nothing to do. It's a relationship. Are you human? What about your dad? You are no more human or no less human than he is, even though you are his son. When he says, I'm the Son of God, he then says, I am, my Father and I are one. He talked about the glory he had before he emptied himself and he was on this earth when the Father was greater than him. When he ascended, before he ascended back into heaven, he said, restore to me the glory that I had before. You know what we've been singing about this morning? Gary, you had no idea. The songs that you selected, that's the whole lesson. It's all about Jesus is the King. He's been raised, and we worship, and we come into the present. And when he called himself the Son of God, John chapter 5 and verse 18 says, you have blasphemed. You have made yourself equal with God. There's a man who lived on this earth, a man of history that says, I have all authority. There's a man who lived on this earth who performed every kind of miracles. And when he performed the miracles, they said, we've never seen anything like this. John chapter 9, the blind man says, since the creation of the world, no man has ever opened the eyes of the blind. How is it that you do not know who he is? You've got to understand this. The response when Jesus was on this earth, whenever he says to the woman, after she says in John chapter 4, we know that the Messiah comes. John chapter 4 and verse 25 says, and I am he. The Messiah is coming. It's not who do men say that I am? Jesus, who are you? I am he. Look at in the text. You see the word he in italics? You know what he said? He said the sacred name of God in reference to himself. What is God's name? At the burning bush, the I am. And when the woman at the well said, the Messiah is coming, Jesus' answer was the very words given at the burning bush, I am. And as you read the book of John, look at how often the word that follows I am and then a pronoun like he, how often those words are in italics. Jesus himself uttered the sacred name of God into reference to himself. Jesus says, I have all authority in heaven. I have all authority in heaven. You know the verse. All authority has been given unto me in heaven and on earth. In heaven, I have the authority over the marriage of angels. All authority has been given unto me. Jesus claimed that he would raise the dead. John chapter 6, three times in John chapter 6. He claimed he would raise the dead. He claims that he would judge all mankind. The Son of Man will come in his glory, and the sheep and the goats will be there, and there will be that separation. All nations will be there. And this man, Jesus, a man of history, said, I am the judge of the world. I am the resurrection. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And this is not on the screen, but get this. He said, no man comes to the Father except through me. John chapter 14, verse 6. A man has lived on this earth that did all of these miracles and did all of these things, and he says, I have authority even in heaven. I will raise the dead and I will judge you, and there's not any man since he has come who will ever go to heaven except through him. And what is remarkable is that whenever he said, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve, he let people worship him. We don't have time to look at that. Just file that away in your head. And as you read the Bible, think of how many people, like Thomas, who saw him, said, my Lord and my God. That's amazing. What's the response to these claims? I want you to understand, anybody can make these claims. Lunatics or televangelists. And they have. Young people, even your parents probably are not old enough to remember. A fellow had a radio program years ago. His name was Father Divine. What happened to him? Oh, he died. Guess what? He's buried. Guess what? He's still in the grave. But you and I need to understand that a man of history made all of these claims. And the omnipotent, all-powerful, the omniscient, the all-knowing, the omnipresent, the ever-present God of heaven heard that man who lived on this earth make every one of these claims. Every word that men speak, they'll give an account thereof in the day of judgment. All things are open and naked before the eyes of him that with whom we have to do. And when this man of history was on this earth and he's saying, I am deity, I am the Son of God, I'm equal with God. The God of heaven saw that. And do you know what the response is? God raised this man from the dead. Let that sink in. God hears everything. And when you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John about the life of Jesus, God heard every word Jesus proclaimed, and God raised him from the dead. That's one response. We know God's response. What is yours? Like those in the first century, you must decide. You must decide. If you're honest, you live in a fairy tale world that's made up of atheism and the exaltation of the will of man above the will of God. You live in that world and never face the facts. But if you're honest, face the facts. The empty tomb says you will be raised from the dead. The empty tomb says you must obey the one who has all authority. The empty tomb says you will give an account. And the empty tomb says, not only should every knee bow before him and confess his name, the scriptures say that on that day, every person who has ever lived will acknowledge who he claimed to be. They will bow their knees and acknowledge that he's what he claimed to be. You're not a Christian? You need to become one. The response you need to make is the response they made in that first century world when they believed that he was the Son of God. It changed their lives. That's repentance. The decision to change is called repentance. You need to make that decision if you're not a Christian. And when they confessed, I believe with all of my heart that Jesus is the Son of God. Based on that confession, they were baptized. Because that is what he who has all authority commands all men everywhere to do. Are you a faithful Christian? If I ask your heart to raise your hand, my life shows that I believe in the empty tomb or the changes you need to make. We want to help everyone go to heaven. And if there's any way we can help you go to heaven, won't you let it be known by coming to the front right now as together we stand and sing.